Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Q2 CIO conference call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Jane Guillen-Moreau. Please go ahead, Ms. Guillen-Moreau.
Thanks very much. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to BMO's second quarter CIO market call. We really appreciate you joining today. My name is Jane Guillen-Moreau, and I'm Vice President and National Director for the investment platform at BMO Harris Private Banking. Joining me today are Paul Taylor and Jack Ablin. As a bit of introduction, Paul is our Chief Investment Officer for Fundamental Equities at BMO Asset Management. Paul is based out of Toronto, and he is responsible for all Canadian equities as well as asset allocation strategy across all of our asset classes. Now, you might remember from prior calls that Paul was formerly, his title was CIO, Chief Investment Officer for BMO Harris Private Banking. In Paul's new expanded role with BMO Asset Management, he continues to provide us here at BMO Private Banking with asset allocation recommendations for our client portfolios. He's also a frequent media commentator in Canada on capital markets and investing topics. We also have Jack Ablin on the line. He's the Chief Investment Officer for Harris Private Bank in Chicago and is widely followed as well in the industry. He's also the author of Reading Minds and Markets, Minimizing Risk and Maximizing Returns in a Volatile Global Marketplace, which, as you might know, has made the global Wall Street Journal's bestseller list. Today, we're going to hear from Paul and Jack, and they're going to share their observations for the markets and the economy as we move into the summer months. However, before we begin, a bit of housekeeping items. I would like to remind everyone that you can ask questions following the presentation. Our operator is Marina today, and she will provide instructions on submitting your questions at that time. This time we're going to start the call a little bit differently, and we're going to ask for Paul and Jack for their general thoughts on an old investing adage that many of us have heard before, sell in Maine, go away. Now, as many of you know, we all have observed equity markets experience a seasonal lull in activity and performance over the May to October period. And if we look back to 1950 or so, on average, the S&P 500 has returned just over 2% per year between May and October. However, during the November to April period, it's returned a much healthier 8% on average per year. So now we're going to turn over to Paul and then Jack, and we're going to look for your comments on this market anomaly. Do investors need to pay attention to these statistics? Do they need to adjust their portfolios in terms of equity allocation during the summer months? What are your thoughts? So, Paul?
Okay. I think there are some valid reasons why historically this notion of sell in May and go away, why it actually came to pass. I mean, there are some, if you look in the sectors, gold, a great example of a sector where there is some very clear seasonality. There are other technical reasons why, the summer months may be a bit slower from an equity perspective. Here in Canada, of course, with the RSP season early in the year, a lot of retail investor focus early in the year, and presumably, any activity that retail clients have, they might cluster it more early in the year and then be a little quieter until until they build their cash balances for activity a little later in the year. But at this particular juncture, the question is, what value is there in the notion of sell in May and go away? I mean, broadly speaking, I would say, yes, I think there is a good chance that the May to August 2012 period may well usher in sort of a consolidation phase for equities. Really, after the very sharp run-up in the October 2011 through March 2012 period, in particular, of course, for Jack's market south of the border, but equally as well, but to a lesser extent, the Canadian equity market did have a good run. And the reason why, I think the next, 3 or 4 months might be a bit of a consolidation phase are kind of threefold. One, continued Eurozone uncertainty. We do have the spring elections in France and Germany. We, of course, had on Sunday, the first round of French elections, and probably raised more questions than it answered as we go into the second set of French elections, come May. Beyond that, the pressure we're seeing in particular for Spanish 10-year government bonds, provide some sense that we're clearly not out of the woods yet as it relates to uncertainty in the Eurozone. And there'll probably be some greater concerns, over the next, couple or 3 or 4 months, just to ensure that, in fact, there isn't a systemic risk related to the Eurozone. The second would be the market's attention on the uncertain pace of slowing in China and will we get a soft or a hard landing. It just, you know, in the shorter term, probably the more pronounced period of whatever slowing we're going to get is probably just ahead of us. The question is, you know, how things will look as we get a little later in the summer. And the third is just concern over the potential waning of momentum in U.S. economic indicators. Obviously, you know, the Q3, Q4, and Q1 of 2012 from U.S. economic perspective was there was some rise in momentum. You know, we saw that until most recently, and some indicators have turned maybe not negative, but they just haven't been as positive as they were. You know, so for instance, you know, we saw initial claims data this morning a little bit elevated the last 3 weeks, and obviously that's translated into somewhat slower employment growth south of the U.S. If you look at that as the litmus test for, you know, the pace of the recovery in the U.S., you know, just a bit of concern about the pace of U.S. momentum that'll probably again be most pronounced over the next few months. So my own perspective, you know, is that we probably have a little bit of a consolidation phase after a sharp run up, and so the old adage of sell in May and go away, you know, is probably something for investors to be mindful of. I think the bigger question though is, you know, what happens once we get beyond there? But we need to keep in mind these old wives' tales of sell a man, go away. They need to be supported by market fundamentals. It just, from my own perspective, happens to line up after a fairly sharp run up, so I think it's more coincident than anything. But I'll be interested in Jack's views.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I'm a numbers guy, so I like to understand the numbers of sell in May and go away. And last year at this time, we did a study where we looked at the Dow Jones, because we've got some good history here, and we went back to 1950. So we went back a little more than 60, or about 60 years or so, took $1,000 and invested it in the Dow between May and October every year, and then put it in cash from November to April, without dividends. $1,000 over that period, over that 60 years, turned into $969. In other words, you could have invested $1,000 for 60 years nearly and lost money if you only invested May through October and you didn't collect dividends. Dividends, obviously, an important part, but the principal value dropped. If, on the other hand, you took that same $1,000 and invested in the Dow between November and April and then sat in cash, or sat on the sidelines, I should say, between May and October, that same $1,000 turned into $22,900, suggesting that virtually the entire return of the Dow over the last 60 years can be explained between November and April. While I certainly agree with some of Paul's thoughts on the thesis behind it, I don't think we can glean enough fundamental support, as Paul mentioned, to really, you know, use this as part of an investment strategy. That said, it certainly influences our tactical view to the extent, say, right now, where, you know, our year-end target for the Dow for the S&P is 1450. You know, we're currently at around 1390, which is, you know, only 4% below our annual target. My sense is if we can get our 1450 by the end of the month, or by sometime in early May, our inclination, keeping this sell in May and go away, metric behind us, suggests that we will use that as an opportunity to start reducing our market risk exposure. So, I guess, you know, it's out there. It's certainly not explained that effectively in my mind, but one that, you know, we need to pay pretty close attention to anyway.
Great, thanks. That's helpful foundation to understanding the statistics. And, Paul, you started talking to us a little bit about your outlook and some of the key factors that you're looking at over the next few months. So let's turn next to talk about that just a bit more. Again, we'll start with you, Paul. Maybe you can elaborate on your outlook for North American markets. If you could comment on some sector news you might have, whether it relates to U.S. Manufacturing rebound, is that getting better? And the other area might be in terms of the energy sector. How are we feeling about oil prices and how will that impact us across North America? And then we'll turn to Jack.
Okay, obviously my perspective is more, you know, Canadian focused, and just to make sure we don't miss the message, you know, I do think that the next, you know, sort of 3 to 5 months will, you know, probably be some sort of a, you know, sideways movement as we sort of consolidate the gains from the last 3 to 6 months. But, you know, I think when we look at things a bit further than that, and then certainly we, you know, we don't try to, you know, guess where the markets are going with the next, you know, sort of 1 to 3 months. We're more focused on 12 months or longer. You know, if we look, you know, beyond the next, you know, few months, moderate upward trajectory in earnings, you know, should be expected. And by that, you know, we'd look at, you know, something on the SPTSX, you know, of the somewhere between 5 and 10% in terms of earnings growth for the market as a whole. And with that as a backdrop, you know, the multiple for the market is probably going to be at least stable. Maybe it expands, you know, very, very modestly from where we are. And really what the market will focus on as we go forward, you know, is those factors that I mentioned earlier, and that is the Eurozone. And I'll get to your, you know, specific question, Jamie, in just a second, but I want to lay the backdrop because it's important for us here in Canada. You know, the Eurozone, there'll be lots of, you know, creaks and groans and a lot of noise, but and there, you know, may be some flurry of activity there, but we don't believe that at the end of the day, over the next 12 months, that there will be a systemic event that will emanate from, you know, from the Eurozone. So we think that there'll be a relatively benign backdrop there, though there'll be you know, some periodic noise. We believe that most importantly for Canada here, and this will tie in, that China will soft, not hard land. It will be slower growth than we've seen over the last, you know, 3 years, but you know, nothing that goes before the or goes below the 7.5% you know, revised target that Chinese authorities have established for growth is on a go forward basis. And most importantly, you know, as it relates to the U.S., that, you know, we'll get a moderate economic backdrop. Interesting to see the Fed yesterday sort of upping modestly their expectation for 2012 from a growth standpoint. So from a Canadian equity perspective, that's a decent backdrop, again, for that kind of high single-digit year-over-year earnings growth, you know, 2012 versus 2011. You know, a P multiple that is stable, maybe slightly ahead. So overall, you get the Canadian equity market hopefully moving forward, moving from, say, 12.1 where it is now to about maybe 13,000, low 13,000 sort of range. Your actual official target is 13,050. You know, so that's a bit of a upside from where we are. As it relates to sectors, the challenge with that backdrop is that it's a decent backdrop for commodities, but not a great backdrop. With oil already elevated, the question is more, you know, does it maintain at or around current levels as opposed to probably moving significantly higher, you know, save for outright conflict in the Middle East, which, you know, hope is not going to come to pass. You know, so from a commodities perspective, would consider, you know, commodities, you know, fairly valued at around current levels. Maybe we get a little bit of a modest upward bias in zinc and copper and nickel prices, you know, but it would be modest upside. So in terms of sector leadership, you know, if you have a global economic expansion, at least of some vigor, you would expect a pro-cyclical sector outlook, which would be overweight consumer discretionary, technology, energy, materials, and underweight utilities, telecom, consumer staples. And if you look at leadership year-to-date, the sectors are all over the place. You know, the leading sectors here in Canada are healthcare. I'm ranking these by strongest. So healthcare first, consumer discretionary, then consumer staples, then financials. worst performing are materials, then telecom, then energy. So we got a mix of both the non-cyclicals at either end of the performance spectrum. So we would have, at the end of the day, we'd have a modestly pro-cyclical sector allocation. You know, I still think that there's value in energy stocks where oil stocks are trading. Very concerned about gas stocks and gas where gas pricing is. Materials modestly positive there, but more sort of the later cycle cyclicals. Yeah, some of the consumer discretionary names are looking a little more interesting from our perspective here north of the border.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. In terms of some of the themes that I'm watching here in the U.S., most notable is one we picked up on about a year and a half ago, and that's the U.S. manufacturing resurgence. Here we've got really a confluence of really favorable elements falling into place and should benefit U.S. growth at the expense of some other developed market competitors. So, for example, while manufacturing wages over the last 10 years really haven't gone very far in the U.S., productivity has. And so that makes unit labor costs in the U.S. Much more attractive than many of our trading partners. I think they're probably our closest rival on the trends in unit labor costs would be Germany. Still, I would say overall, the price of hiring a manufacturing worker today, if you just include wages and productivity, is probably 20 to 25% cheaper now than it was 10 years ago. The second factor built into our relative attractiveness is the fact that the U.S. dollar over the last 10 years is down 35%. So now, on top of that 25% discount due to productivity, you can now add another 35% due to the depreciation of the U.S. dollar versus most major currencies, particularly the euro and the yen. And then lastly, which is I'm going to call our secret ingredient, and that's natural gas. One that Canada and the U.S. share, and that is, we currently enjoy natural gas for consuming natural gas for about $2 per million BTU, and that's substantially cheaper than the natural gas that's trading in Europe right now, which is closer to $8 or $9 per million BTU, and nearly $13 to $15 in Japan. And so you put all of these ingredients together, and we are starting to see a resurgence in manufacturing coming, either expanding, companies expanding within the United States, or actually, coming and opening new facilities here. Those expansions and new facilities will tend to favor what we call the right to work states. These are states generally situated in the South and the East that have much more flexible labor laws and allow big companies to come in without a forced union situation. So it probably isn't a surprise that analysts are expecting earnings growth out of the industrial sector to be nearly 10% this quarter, 8.1% next quarter, and that's about three times the earnings growth rate for the S&P overall.
Great. Thanks, Jack. Another area we're curious about, and maybe getting your views a bit more, would be on the international scene. So Paul commented a bit more about Europe and Eurozone and China. Jack, from your perspective, what are you seeing for those two parts of the world?
Sure. So really, there are obviously two elements to Europe. There's the debt capital structure, and then there's the underlying economy. If you leave Greece out of the equation for a moment, because I think they entered the Eurozone under false pretenses, and just focus on, Spain, Ireland, Portugal, and the kind of the weaker players of the Eurozone, I think that the EU is, going a long way to try to reconfigure debt through subsidizing the banking system. And I'm hopeful there still remains enough demand for new purchases of Spanish debt obligations. But let's assume that they can manage the debt situation well enough. My concern really is the, and we're getting a sense of this from some of the elections now, is that the underlying economies are still weak and getting weaker, and there's really no mechanism or catalyst to revitalize growth and jobs. And so as long as these weaker players are, you know, in this monetary union where the euro is that much more expensive relative to their what would have been their own currency, that's going to create a problem. So I think that the backpedaling or the pushback we're seeing in France, in the Netherlands, and other places shouldn't surprise anybody. I mean, this is just human nature. I think ultimately will prompt policymakers, lawmakers in these countries to go back to their respective currencies. And that's the risk. I mean, it's a risk that it's the transition isn't clean. But if it can be done in a managed way, I think that could actually set the stage for you know, a multi-year bull market if the pieces fall into place. I mean, if you look at traditionally how let's say a country like Greece would have responded had they had their own currency, they would have lowered the value of the drachma. The value of their debt, just like they that with their negotiations with the Eurozone, would have dropped in value. The value of their workforce, just like the negotiations with the Eurozone, would have dropped in value, except now they could put their country on sale and have, you know, invite tourism and exports and all the things that Greece does on a national basis. Unfortunately, due to the euro, and I was just in Greece in last November, I ended up having to pay nearly $100 for a kilo of fresh fish. So it's still a very, very difficult situation there, one where I don't see a clear pathway for economic growth unless they go back to their respective currencies.
Great. Thanks, Jack. What about China? Anything there?
Sure. China, I think the risk here is this is a country that over the last 10 years has done a fantastic job of creating jobs using capital investment. They've done exactly what President Obama would have loved to have done if we had the money here, and that is hire people to build roads, airports, high-speed rail, commercial real estate, residential real estate. And now, as a result of all of this, capital investment accounts for half of Chinese GDP. And so lawmakers, policymakers are hoping to try to shift the emphasis back to household consumption. Unfortunately, household consumption is only about a third of their economic growth, so roughly half of the contribution as it is in the United States. I think their move to liberalize the yuan, to raise the value of their currency, is really one that will help move things along. It'll do actually a lot of things to help rebalance the huge imbalances that are plaguing the world right now. So having a Chinese consumer with stronger currency should help pick up demand. It'll allow us to export to their country. It should also export a little inflation, and they could perhaps import a little disinflation, and one that probably the world needs right now. So that's kind of the trend, and I'm hopeful, as the currency moves up in value, that things will stabilize.
Thanks, Jack. Pardon me. And you touched on something when you mentioned how China's doing in terms of their jobs and creating jobs relative to the U.S. So next, let's go to probably the last topic we want to have before we get to questions and answers is the U.S. political environment and debt situation. So over the next few months, we all know investors are going to be increasingly focused on the U.S. presidential election. From a market perspective, we're looking for two things. One is, what's at stake, given that it's looking increasingly like an Obama versus Romney race? And the other is, when we're looking at the size of U.S. debt, that continues to worry a lot of folks. So is a policy of financial repression the answer?
I believe it is. An easy monetary policy and a Fed that has the keys to the printing press can really paper over a lot of deficiencies, most notably in our country, our inability for our Congress people to pass laws and legislate. And so the Fed has really taken the reins in a lot of respects, and in some respects taken the pressure off Congress to actually act. Obviously, they have to act when we get debt ceiling and things like that, but ultimately, most of the difficult legislation on income and resource allocation is pretty much now out of their hands, and the Fed is really taking charge. And what I mean by this is the Fed is using inflation, or at least interest rates relative to inflation, to start rebalancing. So this is a strategy that was used effectively in 1945. We were able to reduce our public debt from 125% of GDP down to 55% of GDP in 10 years by simply running inflation high and then keeping interest rates low and paying back our debts with cheaper dollars. So what that means is, we can no longer rely on the income from our portfolios to help meet our spending needs, particularly those Americans in retirement. So we've really endeavored to build all new strategies, taking this financial repression theme in mind. And now we have a very different approach to income generation, one that I think is unique and one we've had since 2007 and has been working very well.
Thanks, Jack. Paul, anything you'd want to add on the U.S. presidential election and debt?
Well, of course, we're, as Canadians, we can be somewhat detached, from it. But obviously the ramifications are meaningful for us here, both from an economic and capital market perspective. Jack, I think, accurately characterizes the trade-offs, involved. At the end of the day, we know that there was an overhang of excessive leverage on the part of the U.S. consumer. We transferred that to the public sector, and, it will need to be paid off at some point in time by suppressing interest rates, significantly. That, that lowers the debt servicing charges for the U.S. government. It encourages the U.S. consumer to go out and to spend, and that, thereby, will at least shorter term will stimulate the U.S. economy and give us a chance to sort of grow our way out of all that ails us. From a Canadian perspective, it will be interesting, as Jack says, all the heavy lifting really has been done through monetary policy, and whoever's elected come November, beginning of November, they will have to address the fiscal overhang, and there are no easy answers. So we watch with bated breath, to see what direction is taken as we go forward. Certainly, markets are going to be looking for a coherent, well thought out plan as to how over the next, 5 to 10 years, the U.S., gets itself to a more manageable long-term platform as it relates to the massive overhang of debt that they're struggling with. We can, as Canadians, we can point to a much better fiscal situation here north of the border, but at the end of the day, we know that the U.S. drives the bus, and so we do hope that via the various different policy levers that a thoughtful approach is taken south of the border, but it's not obvious what that direction is going to look like. So we watch with bated breath.
Great. Well, the formal part of our conversation today is done, and we appreciate the comments from both Jack and Paul. We're now going to be opening the line and inviting questions from to any of our panelists. So, Marina, can you provide instructions?
Thank you, Ms. Golden-Moreau. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register for questions. Thank you for your patience. Once again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you have a question.
Great. Well, as we're...
I'm sorry. We have a question from Claire Sabani from Reuters. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jack and Paul. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on Canadian earnings today. You know, over the past couple weeks, we've seen higher than expected earnings in the U.S. lift markets there. But what do you think we can expect for the TSX after the first round of earnings here this week have so far mostly disappointed expectations?
Yeah. I mean, if you look year over year, you know, I sort of referenced the notion of kind of, you know, somewhere in the 6 to 8% lift year over year. Our target, if you look at of the 12 months ending March 31st, 2013, is that we deliver somewhere in the neighborhood of about $900 on the SPTSX composite, and that's coming from a figure. Actually, I can get to the figure for 2011 was $844. So you take, you know, $60 on an 840 base, that gets you, you know, your high single digits kind of year-over-year earnings growth. In the shorter term, I mean, obviously we've had, you know, very strong oil pricing, very weak natural gas pricing. The banks are, you know, struggling a little bit to, you know, to deliver meaningful earnings growth. And then the other big one would be the base of precious metals. We've had a little bit weaker tone in base metals pricing, so you know, very short term, we're going to have our earnings for you know, Q1 2012, you know, do reflect that. But if your view is as ours is that we get a little bit of firming on the commodity front, the banks, you know, are doing the right thing in terms of expense management. You know, again, I think that that trajectory of 6 to 8% earnings growth year over year is very doable.
Sorry, is 6 to 8% on the quarter or for the whole year?
Sure, that's for the whole year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. Please press star 1 if you have a question.
Sure, well, maybe as we're waiting for any other questions to come in, an area that's certainly interesting for a lot of our clients is the real estate market. And we know that in the U.S., we're seeing a lot of signals suggesting we're reaching or at the bottom. Paul, and then I'll turn over to Jack to validate maybe what I'm suggesting. But Paul, for the Canadian market, can you comment on that for us, for real estate?
Yeah, I mean the sense is the Canadian equity market, sorry, Canadian real estate market may be approaching sort of bubble levels, and certainly I think on a you know, on a regional basis, we have some markets that you would have to suggest that there is a probability that the Vancouver markets and potentially the condo market in Toronto, you know, might be in that territory. And obviously that's caught the attention of Finance Minister Flaherty and Bank of Canada head Carney, who, you know, have warned Canadians that generationally low interest rates, you know, may be leading to behavior that the consumer level, you know, is concerning. And if you look at the key metrics, and that is house prices relative to rents or house prices relative to income, there's no doubt that the Canadian real estate market, you know, does look like it's a bit extended, but I would point to it being very, very regional. That having been said, you know, we do have a very different real estate market structurally than the U.S., you know, in that, you know, our mortgage market is different. You know, our loan to value is much more closely managed here than certainly it was in the U.S. Our mortgages are full recourse as opposed to non-recourse as in the U.S. And mortgage insurance plays a much bigger part here in Canada. And then, of course, the big one, and that is mortgage interest is not deductible for tax purposes. So, I mean, structurally, I think we're much more sound than the U.S. housing market was. You know, I would say that, you know, versus the major indicators, again, prices relative to rents or versus income, we are extended at the national level, but I think that is largely led by a couple of regional markets that are In particular, Vancouver, it's hard, you know, to make the argument that there isn't some frothy activity there. You know, but the national level, I maybe slightly ahead of where we should be, but I think to reference it at the national level as a bubble is a misnomer.
Yeah, and you know, from my perspective in the U.S., you know, housing prices are now trading at what we will call fair value on a national basis relative to some of our economic metrics. These were the same metrics we used in the third quarter of 2006 that suggested that on a national basis, housing prices were 22% overvalued. So that's the good news. The bad news is we've got a, you know, still a supply and demand mismatch. We've got a latent supply out there of either bank balance sheet or those houses or units in foreclosure, and those just vacant and on the sidelines. So we suspect that while values can potentially drop a little further from here, that most of the worst housing price downtrend is behind us, and that actually by this time next year, we'll have a normal housing selling season, at least when gauged on a national basis. We think there are a couple of pockets that still will linger. Florida, while it certainly benefits from Canadian buyers and other foreign buyers, still probably will lag behind the rest of the country. And other what we'll call retirement markets may lag as we need some of the mainstay markets to stabilize first so that those would-be retirees can sell their homes and then buy subsequently in these retirement markets. But overall, as I said, prices we're pretty comfortable with. Now it's just a matter of working through the excess supply.
Great. Thank you. Operator, are there any questions at the moment?
There are no further questions registering at this time, Ms. Gillian-Morrow.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, hopefully you all got a lot of information from our conversation today, and this concludes our call. The call will be archived online at www.bmoharrisprivatebanking.com. If you're interested in an audio recording or the transcript of this call, please arrange or if you'd like to arrange a follow-up interview with Paul or Jack, please contact Rachel McKay, and she can be reached at 416-867-3996. Thanks again for joining us today, and we're looking forward to having you rejoin in July. Thank you. Good day.
Thank you. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for your participation.